A warm welcome back to all of you to this live session at Wydemoat Investing Summit 2016. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back to Value Conferences returning instructor Jeffrey Stacey, founding partner of Stacey Muirhead Capital Management. Jeff is joining us from Waterloo, just outside of Toronto, Canada. He has more than 25 years of experience in the investment industry and not only runs the firm, but also serves as portfolio manager for the Stacey Muirhead Limited Partnership and the Stacey Muirhead RSP Fund. We have truly had the pleasure and honor of learning from Jeff in the past, and we very much value his insights and ideas and look forward to what he has in store for us today. I will be back to moderate the Q&A session following Jeff's remarks, and I encourage all of you to type your questions into the online interface at any time. And with that, Jeff, I'd like to turn it over to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be able to do this this morning. I believe this is the third time I've participated in this Wydemoat Investing Summit. I always enjoy it. And just, you know, before I start, congratulations to you, John, and Shai, for all that you do to advance the art and science and craft of investing. I think it's just terrific. So congratulations to both of you. So I've got an idea that I would like to present today. I guess my opening comment would be, if it's not a wide moat, I certainly think it's at least a reasonable business, but I'll let all of you judge that as we go along. So let me just maybe make a couple of observations before we get into the presentation. I think that most people intuitively grasp the idea of Wydemoat investing and are trying to make investments, but on that basis. But it's simple to say and not easy to do. And I think that oftentimes there's probably three main pitfalls that I see over and over again, and certainly we've been guilty of it here at our firm. And the first one is just misjudging the size and durability of a moat. You know, how wide is the moat and how long will that competitive advantage persist? And it's just, those are qualitative judgments you have to make that based on perhaps some quantitative information, but it's just not easy to do. And then I think the other thing that happens is people can often pay too much for a moat, and you know, I'm just always guided by you know, the Buffett Munger concept. You know, even the world's greatest business is not a great investment if you pay too much for it. So you know, it still comes down to price in the end, no matter how good the business is. And then the third thing I would just make a quick comment on is, I think oftentimes we put too much emphasis on the quantitative and not enough on the qualitative. And I think understanding what really constitutes a wide moat company, it involves making judgments about qualitative aspects of assessing that company. So that's just some quick comments. Identifying wide moat opportunities. I was listening to a number of the presentations yesterday, and you know, I'm going to use similar language. You know, we try to answer three main questions. Does this business that we're looking at and considering, does it possess outstanding business economics? Does it have honest and capable management and owner-oriented management teams? And then, can you buy that investment at an attractive price? And, you know, we just use this simple phraseology around Stacey Muirhead: great business, great people, great price. So I know a bunch of the speakers the last couple of days have had similar ways of thinking about this, and we're certainly no different than some of the other presenters you've had so far. So just a laundry list, not an all-inclusive list, certainly. And, you know, when you're assessing companies, you don't always get everything, but, you know, in terms of the business economics, does it have outstanding business economics? We're looking for high returns on shareholder equity, strong balance sheet, minimal no debt, attractive operating net profit margins, oftentimes brand recognition, significant brand recognition is a key trait. Does it have pricing power? Like others, you know, we just want to buy a business that can continue to grow its revenue and earnings over time. Nothing's a straight line up, but certainly you want to see that trend. And does it generate consistent free cash flow generation? Or the phrase Buffett likes to use, owner earnings. So we're no different. That's the shopping list. Does it have honest and capable management? Over many years, I guess we've just come to the conclusion that one of the key things you need to think about is, does the management team have skin in the game? Have they purchased an ownership interest in this business with their own money, and do they have a substantive part of their own net worth invested in the business on the same basis as us? Looking for reasonable compensation practices, and particularly where there's pay for performance that you can actually measure or understand or agree that you know they have demonstrated performance, and now there's a pay package that ties to that. Demonstrated integrity. You know, one of your prior instructors at past events, Tom Gaynor, has often joked. He said, you know, if you have someone who's very capable but isn't honest, you know, run as fast as you can. And, you know, I think there are clues that you can get when you look at businesses to see whether that management team has demonstrated integrity. And certainly the example I'm going to show you today, there's an example on the record of that. Capital allocation record, can they make acquisitions? Can they, you know, get high returns on invested capital, incremental invested capital? And then finally, does it have a unique corporate culture, and management as the prime culture carriers and the prime leadership? You know, that's very important. You know, I presented Fairfax Financial a year ago at this conference, and I mean, whether you like or don't like Fairfax Financial, I think we'd all agree that that's a company with a very unique corporate culture and a very unique corporate leader in Prem Watsa. So those are the things we think about around management. And then finally, you know, can it be purchased at an attractive price? I don't really have much to say in that. We use all the same tools as everybody else, but I was struck by this quote from Warren Buffett, which I think really goes to the heart of what you're trying to do when you're a wide moat investor. And so your goal as an investor should be simply to purchase at a rational price a part interest in an easily understood business whose earnings are virtually certain to be materially higher 5, 10, or 20 years from now. So the overriding premise of how we go into the price part of the equation. So let's move on to the example. Company I want to talk to you about today is Polaris Industries, a company that's in the what's referred to as the power sports manufacturing and marketing business. And so let me just try and make that real for you. They make off-road vehicles, so both what's called all-terrain vehicles, which are one rider, there's an example of that in the right corner, and then side-by-side vehicles, which are the other two pictures. Collectively, the whole group's known as off-road vehicles. They also make motorcycles, started with Victory back in the 90s, and several years ago they purchased the Indian Motorcycle brand name out of essentially bankruptcy and totally re-engineered the product line, and it's been a fabulous success, growing quite rapidly for them. It allowed them to reposition the Victory brand. And then they have, you see in the middle there, slingshots, which are on-road, three-wheeled roadster vehicles that's creating a whole new class in and of itself. They also make snowmobiles. That was the original heritage of the company. That's only about 7% of the business by revenues today. Product line or a company they purchased in the last year or so, timber sled. There's an example of a timber sled in the bottom right corner. That's a where you take a off-road motorbike, take the wheels off and attach a ski and a belt, and that's sort of the new a new trend that's emerging, very small for the company but doing quite well off a small base. And then over the last few years, they've pushed out, if you will, into closely aligned product areas and what they refer to as global adjacent markets. You see their electric vehicles under the GEM brand name for moving people and around. They just recently purchased Taylor Dunn. You'll often see Taylor Dunn tractors at airports moving the baggage around. And then they've also pushed into defense, primarily with their off-road vehicles. You see two examples there. That's a good business for them. And they find they're replacing Jeeps in a lot of military usage situations. So global adjacent markets, and then pulling that all together is, of course, they sell the parts, garments, and accessories to all of those product areas. So just trying to make it real for you and give you a bit of an understanding of what the company's products are and what they do. Quick overview. Company was founded in 1954 as a snowmobile manufacturer, so it's been around over 50 years, has 8,100 employees worldwide, 16 manufacturing locations and 5 R&D centers around the world, 3,500 dealers worldwide, so they sell to dealers and dealers in turn sell to end users. Of that 3,500 dealers, about 1,800 is in North America, Canada, the United States, and the remainder is in the rest of the world, so it's split about 50-50 that way. And in 2015, they shipped over 390,000 units in total between snowmobiles, off-road vehicles, and motorcycles, and sold their products in over 100 countries around the world. So a little bit of an overview of what the company is and does. In terms of market data, just using the price at the end of May was $85.02. It's 80.81 today. There were 64.6 million shares outstanding as of the latest 10Q for the quarter ended March 31st. Gives you a market capitalization of about $5.5 billion. So let's go through and let's try and answer the three questions that I showed you earlier and see if Polaris meets the tests or not. So does it possess superior economics, business economics? First thing I'd say, significant brand recognition. So they're number one in ATVs. They're number one in side-by-sides, number two in motorcycles and snowmobiles in terms of market share in North America for the 2015 calendar year. So that's a good base to start with, and that's an impressive market share position to leverage and to move forward with. So significant brand recognition. Growing revenue and earnings, and I've just given you the last 5 years. You can see sales revenue grew from 2.6 to call it 2.7 billion to 4.7 billion. You can see the year by year growth rate down at the bottom, or the line in the middle is net income. Net income went from 228 million to 455 million, was basically flattish or only up slightly in the last year. And sales were not up as much in the last year as they had been the prior four. If you took a longer snapshot, going back a decade or longer, they've grown revenue and earnings at sort of double-digit rates of return, so 10 to 12 to 15% for a long, long time. And then down at the bottom there, you see earnings per share went from 320 to 675 over the last 5 years, and you see the growth rates. And then again, just would comment, last year, 2015, was a slower growth, and we're going to talk to that in a couple of minutes as to what's going on there and why did that happen. Industry-leading returns. So just giving you returns on assets and return on invested capital. You can see there they are generating impressive returns and industry-leading returns. So the black line is a peer average, includes Bombardier, Harley-Davidson, Arctic Cat, other companies. Clearly, they're outperforming their peer group, and they're outperforming the S&P 500 average on those measures. So any way you stack it up, I think they have pretty impressive returns on assets and pretty impressive return on invested capital. And then high returns on shareholder equity. Again, there's the last 5 years. You know, they've consistently averaged above 30% returns on shareholder equity without leveraging the balance sheet, and I'll talk to that in just a moment. So those are pretty high rates of return and attractive rates of return. So as to the financial position, at the end of the last quarter, you can see they have debt and capital lease obligations of a little over $500 million against almost $1 billion in shareholder equity. Debt to total capital, 36%, not excessive. And then you can see up at the top there, they have about $146 million in cash. So if you take that off, the net debt to total capital is 26%. So not perfect. We often like to invest in companies that have net cash or no debt or net cash. Polaris doesn't meet that test necessarily, but I don't think this is a company that's leveraged excessively. Increasing dividends per share. You can see the growth rate there over the last several years. First quarter was paid at a rate of 55 cents, so I'm assuming it'll be 220 for the year, and will show a modest increase year over year. You know, they've been good capital stewards in terms of increasing dividends over time. They also have purchased stock, as well as made a number of acquisitions along the way, and we talked to Taylor Dunn a moment ago and Timber Sled earlier in the presentation. Consistent and opportunistic share repurchases. I just went back to 2000 and gave you the shares outstanding at the end of each year, adjusted for splits. I should make that comment that there's been a split along the way. You see there 64.6 million at the end of the first quarter. That's down 29.6 million or 31.4% since 2000. So pretty consistent share repurchasers. They also have been opportunistic. So in the first quarter, you can see they bought back 1.1 million shares when the share price was down considerably from where it had been trading. So they're not afraid to step on the gas when they think the share price is right. And so, you know, I could be showing this as well, I guess, under the management, trying the report card on management, but thought it was appropriate to show it here. So I think capital allocation, they're doing a lot of things right, but consistent and opportunistic share repurchases. So that's a quick report card, if you will, on whether this company has outstanding business economics. Let's just run you through it one last time. Does Polaris have superior business economics? Well, good brand recognition, you know, growing revenue and earnings over time, kind of low double digits for a long period of time. It's been faster than that over the last 5 years and slower than that in the last year, but growing revenue and earnings over time. Industry-leading returns, both relative to markets at large and certainly relative to their peer group, and very attractive numbers in that regard. High returns on shareholder equity, consistently above 30% for a long, long period of time. Solid financial position. They don't have, they do have some debt, but I don't think it's excessive, and I think it's a reasonable balance sheet. And then they've increased dividends over time, and they've been consistent and opportunistic share repurchasers. So in my mind, this is a business that does possess superior economics. So question one, I would say yes. So let's move on to the second question. Does it have honest and capable management, in particular managers who are owner-oriented or shareholder-oriented and think and act like owners? Well, let's, again, I'll just try and give you some data points to support whether that's true or not. Directors and officers as a group own 2.2 million shares. That's about 3.4% of the total outstanding. Scott Wine, the CEO, has about 750,000 shares personally. You can do the math at $85 a share or $80 a share. It's well over $50 million. So I would argue that he does have skin in the game. Polaris has an employee share ownership plan, which also has 3.8 million shares or 5.9%. So between directors, officers, employees, you've got, you know, give or take 10% of the shares accounted for. So I think that's interesting. Scott Wine, the CEO, has been CEO since 2008, doing a great job. The track record shows that. The CEO prior to Scott Wine, Tom Tiller, was also a longtime CEO, serving for about a decade. So I like the continuity of management. I think you know, you've got an honest and capable management team here. Solid shareholder-oriented board. I mean, you can go look at the proxy circular and see all the members. I just highlight, you know, two examples very quickly for you. A fellow by the name of Gary Hendrickson, who is the CEO of Valspar, a paint company. Obviously, a lot of these products need to be painted. I think he can bring some expertise to Polaris from that regard. John Wyhoff, the lead directors with C.H. Robinson, the logistics firm. Obviously, there's a lot of transportation involved in getting these products to market, so I think that's a good fit. But I encourage you to look at the proxy circular and make your own judgment in that regard. Great capital allocation record. I mean, I touched on it. You know, they've been acquirers along the way. Certainly, the Indian motorcycle brand was a coup. You know, Taylor Dunn more recently. But they've also paid increasing dividends and have been consistent share repurchasers when it made sense to do so. So, in my mind, no one has a perfect capital allocation record, but they've done an awfully good job in that regard. You know, I talked about culture earlier. So what, you know, Polaris, what are their guiding principles? So best people, best team, safety and ethics always, customer loyalty. Just want to give you one example. They are going through a product recall right now on one of their lines of off-road vehicles, and they worked quite diligently with the consumer protection authorities, and they made the decision to actually recall more than the authorities were asking them to do, just so that everyone could be certain that they'd address the issues. And so that's that example of, you know, integrity, a unique culture. I think they've got it, and so that was something that was of interest to us. Excuse me. Performance objectives. Their goal is to grow sales to $8 billion by 2020. That'd be a 12% compound. They have some sub goals within that, you know, in terms of growing internationally and growing their global adjacent products business. But, you know, just to make this simple, they're hoping to grow and are attempting to grow sales to $8 billion by 2020. That would be a 12% CAGR, consistent with their long-term experience. They hope to increase net income to more than 10% of sales. They have had net margins above 10% in the past. They dipped last year, which we'll talk to that in a moment, but that would be a 13% compound. And so again, consistent with growth record in the past, and we would like to think that they can do that. So finally, can it be purchased at an attractive price? And let me just say, I have no magic formula. You know, you just try and look at it and try and make an assessment whether you're buying something at a reasonable price, and think back to the Buffett quote that you feel reasonably confident will be able to increase its earnings 5, 10, 20 years from now. So let's start just a simple price chart in the last year. You can see the stock is off quite sharply. That's what got us interested. The high and low over the last year was $156, and it bottomed in January at $67.80. It's about, $85 at the end of May, $80 to $81 today. You know, that drop from high to low was 56.6%. That's a big number. So let's maybe start, what created that opportunity? I think while there's many factors I've highlighted, I think what are the three most important ones. So currency exchange fluctuations, with the US dollar having increased so dramatically against virtually every other currency in the world, and particularly Canada, had a poor earnings than expected in the last year, owing to currency exchange issues. And yes, they hedge, but it's just difficult when your home currency is outperforming every other currency in the world, and that makes all your foreign business translated back look worse. Well, you know, these things are going to come and go, and we just think if you look at it over a long enough period, that's not something that you should get unduly fussed about. And quite frankly, I think to a great degree, it's outside the control of the management of Polaris. So, dealer inventory concerns. This is a more real issue, and it's infected the entire industry, and Polaris was not immune from it. Basically, there was too much inventory in the system. Polaris attempted to address that in the fourth quarter. They shut the plants for a while. The fourth quarter numbers were particularly poor. Remember, they still set a record in revenue and earnings for the last year, but it was only up marginally on the year before, primarily because they sold a lot less into the system to try and get those dealer inventories down. You know, we're living in economic times where consumer, big ticket consumer discretionary items are not being purchased. Again, I can't tell you, that's a very real issue. I can't tell you when it will correct itself, but I'm reasonably confident today that Polaris has their dealer inventories down to the low end of where they want them to be from a sell-through point of view. So third issue, paint capacity issues. And you know, we talked about the margins getting hit last year. This was one of the big drivers of that. So the situation basically was that because Indian motorcycles are growing so dramatically, up about 180% last year off a small base. Remember, this was a company that, you know, 5 years ago, Polaris bought out of bankruptcy and then re-engineered the brand, and so we're basically in early days from a brand new start for Indian. It's going very, very well. Well, of course, because it's going better than expected, they didn't have enough paint capacity in their manufacturing system to deal with it. So what happened? They had to get contract with third parties to paint some of the motorcycles. Well, of course, that's quite costly because you have to transport the motorcycle to the third party and then transport it back after it's painted. And so that has been an issue that was hitting margins. I will merely say this is a fixable problem. Polaris is a company with a 40-year-plus, 50-year-plus manufacturing heritage. They build engines. They do lots of things. They're working on it, and they have substantively corrected the problem already. They also have a brand new plant in Huntsville, Alabama, that's coming online soon, which will also deal with some of these capacity issues that they've been grappling with. So, in my mind, of these three main things, one's beyond their control. Two, they're dealing with quite aggressively, and we think that the share price overreacted. So let me try and give you a basic sense of valuation. So using the share price at the end of May, $85.02, it's trading at 12.6 times 2015 earnings. Okay, the expectations are for a slight decrease to earnings in 2016. We'll see if that comes to pass. I think those are very conservative estimates, but basically they'll flatline in 2016, maybe go down ever so slightly. Dividend yield today, 2.6%. And then I just referenced some earlier numbers, so great return on shareholder equity last year, but accomplishing that with a reasonable balance sheet. So we would like to think this is an attractive valuation, just on some very simplistic measures. So those of you who saw my presentation a year ago on Fairfax, I had a slide, what price could Fairfax trade at, not will or would, and I got more questions both at the time and after the fact about that slide, so I thought I'd try and do it again in the context of Polaris. So what are my assumptions here? I think they'll get to their $8 billion sales goal in 2020 that they've articulated. I've put in margins of 11%. Maybe I'm being a bit high on that, but they've articulated 10%. They've done 10 and greater in the past, so let's say net margins of 11%. Well, that would give you net income of $880 million in 2020, and I'm saying at that point in time, there'll be 55.5 million shares outstanding. I showed you, it had been cut by almost a third over the last 15 years. That's about a 2.5%, 3% a year. They've been a little more aggressive lately. So if you just keep on the same pace that they've been at for a long period of time, that would get you to about 55.5 million shares at the end of 2020. So what might this look like in terms of return? Well, current market price, 85. Earnings per share in 2020, if they meet those assumptions, will be $15.85. If we use the same multiple, which I think is a low multiple, I certainly don't dispute that there might be margin or multiple expansion, but if it trades at 12.6 times earnings, that gives you a market price of $199.71 in 2020, and that represents an annual compounded rate of return of 18.6% plus the dividends, which are currently 2.7% dividend yield, which we expect to continue going up over time. But dividend yield gets you over 20% annual compounded rate of return if they meet these numbers, and then what else might there be in terms of multiple expansion over time. So clearly we think we're buying something at a price that represents a discount today to intrinsic value. We would like to think, in line with that Buffett quote, that this is a business that will have higher, materially higher earnings in 5, 10, 20-year time horizon, and so we think we're setting up an attractive rate of return from here. So just in summary, I think this is a company that is a great business run by great people that's available at, if not a great price, at least a reasonable price, and so we would like to think it's a wide moat. If it's not a wide moat, I certainly think it's an above-average business. So that's my pick this year, and that's my story, Polaris Industries. Happy to take any questions. So back to you, John.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for the presentation as well as the idea. Really enjoyed how you articulated both on the business side as well as the valuation. Just a reminder to everyone, if you have a question, you can type it into the online interface. I'm going to take one question from the queue and then go to Shai for additional questions. The question essentially asks about the competitive landscape. Is there anything on the horizon? What gives you confidence that they'll be able to maintain their competitive advantage?
Well, certainly, I mean, that's something you worry about all the time. And, you know, Polaris has been up against some very large competitors. Think Suzuki, Kawasaki, you know, certainly Harley in motorcycles, Honda. They've been able to do it for a long, long period of time. And they've been the small, scrappy guy that continues to take market share year by year by year. So, you know, I don't see any signs of that lessening. There's nothing I can point to that would lead you to believe that that's going to happen, but certainly that's something that we pay great attention to and try and think through over time. I guess my response is just that, you know, they've already done it, and we see no reason why they can't continue to grow market share and to push out into new adjacent product categories and to push out geographically year by year. This is primarily a North American company today, but, you know, is growing in Europe, growing around the world. So yeah, you that's the essence of something that you worry about. There's no guarantees, but I certainly also have to say I don't recognize or don't see any signs that their competitors have better product or better strategy that's going to diminish Polaris over time. To this point, I would actually say the opposite is happening, but certainly that's something you worry about.
Thank you, Jeff. Shai, please go ahead.
Jeff, this is a particularly great presentation, so thank you specifically for such wonderful insight. I'd love to actually follow up on the previous question in more detail. Could you share with us what data points you're keeping an eye on to assess if the moat is getting more wide or the moat is getting more narrow?
Well, certainly market share for the product line. Certainly, one of the things I didn't touch on that I perhaps should have is for Indian Motorcycles today, there's only about 180 dealers. Of course, many of those dealers sell other Polaris product lines as well. But, you know, to this point, Indians taking share, particularly from Harley. They're hoping to grow their dealer network quite substantively over time. But, you know, this has enabled them, you know, when they started Victory back in the late 90s, I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but, you know, anybody who wanted to sell the product line was given a dealership. You know, as they've grown, as they've won technological awards for their technology and engineering, they've been able to also increase their dealers over time. So there's no single measure. We try to talk to dealers where we can. We look at market share. We look at you know, product reviews. Are their product lines being favorably reviewed? No, there's no single measure you can point to, but you just try and stay on top of it and assess, you know, assess on a comprehensive basis, I guess, what's happening in the competitive landscape.
I'd love to please ask about insider incentives and alignment. Could you share with us at a broad level, what key metrics are driving insider compensation?
Growing sales and revenue and returns on capital are the primary drivers. I actually meant to mention it and I didn't. There was an example where I think we've got a well-aligned management team and pay for performance. So even though on one hand you could say, well, 2015 was record revenue and earnings for this company. The CEO, Scott Wine, received no annual bonus because the growth rate was actually lower than it had been historically. So he didn't meet his annual targets. So on the annual piece of his compensation, he didn't get that performance bonus. And so, you know, again, no compensation programs perfectly. Sometimes as an outsider, it's actually hard to truly understand the incentives that are that a compensation committee has granted to a management team. But from my chair, it's tied to, you know, revenue, earnings, returns on shareholder capital, all the things we think performance, pay for performance should be based on. So I have no issues. Again, nothing's perfect, but I have no issues or no real glaring issues with how they've structured the incentive compensation at Polaris.
John, back to you, please.
Thank you, Shai. Jeff, there's a question on the dealer network and the service side of the business. The questioner says we did some work on them and found there was either currently a good network or evolving one, similar to John Deere, even if it's not quite as robust. So could you comment on maybe the strength that comes from that side of the business?
Well, I think that's well said. You know, clearly having a good dealer network is critical to the success of Polaris going forward. And so, you know, these things are evolutionary. I think the dealer network's good, but I'm particularly excited, again, you know, to see how they might be able to leverage Indian Motorcycles into, you know, a continuing upgrade of their dealer network over time. You know, service is important, obviously. Having, you know, we just briefly touched on parts, garments, and accessories, but having, you know, service aligned where you've got the appropriate parts and supplies at the dealer, it's absolutely critical. And the company's been working a lot with their dealer network in terms of improving that. The ordering of certainly new vehicles for sale, but also, you know, the parts and garments and accessories and various supplies to the dealer network. And I think they're making real strides in that regard. But I guess, you know, again, these things are evolutionary. There's always room for improvement. But if I had to, I certainly can't score the dealer network poorly today. And in fact, quite the opposite. I think it's a pretty good dealer network and getting stronger.
A question on whether you speak with management. Do you see value in doing that, in assessing their honesty, or do you try to assess it independently by observing their actions and comparing to their words?
Both. Certainly, in this case, and being totally candid and frank about it, I have not had direct conversations with Scott Wine, the prior CEO. We used to own this many years ago, sold it, and have come back to it in the last year. So I have not talked to Scott Wine. Did have conversations with Tom Tiller when he was there. You know, I think the simple answer to the question is to the extent that you can, both of those things are very helpful. You know, just to state the obvious, all CEOs know what investment people want to hear, and you don't get to the CEO position without understanding what you need to tell the investment community. So part of, you know, the simple but not easy piece of wide mode investing is just trying to make those qualitative judgments, and clearly you don't always get it right. And, you know, we've made mistakes where we've been let down by management teams, but I think to the greatest extent possible, we've done what we can at this point to assess the quality of the management team at Polaris, and we will continue to engage and try and understand and pick up insights into certainly the business, but in this context into management and how they think and act, and particularly the honesty piece, the capability piece, and the alignment piece. So the answer is both. We try to do both.
Jeff, there's a question on just probing the growth. The questioner says, wouldn't a significant driver of the stock price decline be the flat line of 2015 over 2014 earnings growth, and basically the market thinking that growth has ceased? And to that point, what do you see as the revenue growth catalysts going forward?
I think that's the first part of that's entirely fair. Certainly that's part of the piece. This was a company that had grown and had pretty consistent growth. And of course, last year, you know, modest top line and bottom line growth, you know, 2 to 5% below their historic norms. I think that's fair. Again, you know, I think part of the problem on why the growth rate was lower last year is because they took the voluntary decision to get their dealer inventory down. So if, or making the assumption that we now have dealer inventories in good shape, and certainly Polaris points to data that says it, that they're at the low end now of where they want to be, I would argue over time that, you know, they've been doing this for a long, long period of time, but this is still not a company where size is the anchor of performance. You know, maybe they can't do double digit. You know, we need them to do double digit to make those numbers we talked about earlier. But, you know, if they don't meet those numbers, you know, and you sort of translate the math through, you know, we could be looking at, you know, 10, 12, you know, 14% compounds. I'm okay with that. So, you know, I think the biggest drivers to growth going forward are certainly Indian Motorcycles has given them a platform that can allow them to grow. This is a company that has to this point been primarily North American focused. Yes, they do sell in 100 countries around the world, but, you know, there's an effort here to take the company out geographically away from its North American base. So that can provide a growth component here if they are successful in executing on that. You know, just to give you one example of that, they have a joint venture in India, producing a small motorized vehicle that can be used on tight streets to deliver product. So there's just one example of them executing geographically. And then you know, the final piece of it is the product adjacencies, whether new product lines they develop or acquisitions that they make. So, you know, Taylor Dunn's a good example of that. So I do think the economic environment has been tough for them. Certainly in off-road vehicles last year, the oil and gas industry or oil and gas producing states are a big market for off-road vehicles. And so clearly that was contracted quite sharply last year, which also led to the numbers. So, you know, it's a glass half full, glass half empty kind of argument from my perspective. I certainly appreciate others may see it differently, but from my perspective, I think this is a company that has ample growth opportunities ahead of them in terms of existing product lines, Indian, new product adjacencies, geographical expansion, and so again, you know, only time, the fullness of time will tell whether they can meet those, you know, 12% CAGR numbers over the next 5 years on sales. But even if they don't, I just am not in the camp that would suggest it will be, you know, flatlining or 1 or 2% growth for a long period of time. But you know, that's the essence of the investment bet that we've made, is that, you know, we believe that they can do it, but only the fullness of time will assess whether we're right or not.
I'd love to please step in with a rather interesting question. Mm-hmm. In February 2015, Berkshire Hathaway expressed an interest in the motorcycle apparel and accessories industry. Mm-hmm. To what degree do you believe that there is a similar product portfolio and similar unit economics to the German Berkshire subsidiary?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have any particular insight. I should have mentioned it actually during my presentation. The other thing that Polaris has been doing is they've been buying parts, garments, and accessories manufacturers. A recent example, 509. So if you go to, I think the website's 509.com, but you know, this is kind of a trendy brand of, you know, helmets and goggles that you know, are very sought after at the moment. So certainly, you know, Polaris has been engaging in a strategy that is similar to Berkshire's acquisition of the German company. I'm not sure I have anything specific to say in terms of comparing that company to Polaris's parts, garments, and accessories organizations, but certainly if you know, you could perhaps take Berkshire's acquisition as confirmation that this isn't a bad place to have capital deployed.
If I can actually play devil's advocate, do you worry about go private risk, so there might not be a multi-decade compounder trajectory?
Yes. I actually think it's interesting that the employee share ownership plan is there in that regard. So sure, could it happen? Absolutely. At, you know, 4 billion or 5 billion top line, this is an imminently doable transaction for private equity. So certainly you worry about that. I would just make the point the company's been around for 50 plus years. Certainly haven't heard or there's never been a hint of that happening, but could it happen? Absolutely.
Jeff, John here again. There's a question on the brand and how that's related to the moat. The questioner says that if you look at the auto industry, the brands have not really helped the companies achieve higher ROIC. How do you see the recreational vehicle space as being different on that count?
Well, again, I guess my only, this is sort of the rear view mirror question as opposed to looking out the front windshield of the car. They have had high returns on invested capital historically for a long, long period of time. So it would appear that the brand is, you know, has moat value. But again, you know, you're constantly paying attention to try and assess whether the competitive dynamic changes that or not. I do not see any evidence of that today, but that it's a great question in the sense of if this migrates the way the automobile industry has, then, you know, it's probably not a wide moat, and it's probably not going to be a great compounder for us. But I just see no evidence of that today. But that's certainly something you have to be vigilant to.
And one question, again, straying a bit off into automotive. It says the company is an automotive in the wider sense. If you take BMW, similar balance sheet record and half the valuation, are the concerns for the automotive industry misplaced, i.e. peak volumes, electric powertrain, etc.?
Great question. I'm not sure I have anything intelligent to say around that. I mean, you know, it is a fact. BMW certainly on simple valuation measures is would appear to be attractively priced, but I've got to take a pass on that one. I'm sorry.
Sure. And Jeff, there is a question from a past participant. If you wouldn't mind providing a bit of an update on Fairfax and the reinsurance business going forward. The questioner alludes to a Buffett comment that the outlook may not be as great as the past.
Sure. I mean, like Berkshire, Fairfax also has a lot of primary property and casualty insurance, so it's not solely a reinsurance business. I think Buffett's right to make those comments, and you know, and I think broadly speaking, it's just so difficult for insurance companies to make money when interest rates are as low as they are. So you have to, you know, you have to have your underwriting margin down, you know, certainly, you know, well into the 90s, and I would argue into the 80s to drive return. Now, I think although there's no evidence of interest rates increasing in the short to medium term, at some point interest rates will turn up, and that will create opportunities for on the investment side of property and casualty insurance companies to make money. I mean, the only other comment specifically that I would make about Fairfax is they continue to build out what I think is an exceptional global platform for property and casualty, primary property and casualty insurance underwriting and they continue to build and strengthen on that. You know, investments have been tough for everybody, particularly tough in Fairfax's case because they've had a negative tilt in their investment portfolio and have been very concerned about markets. I suspect in the last month or so, things have looked a lot better on their investment portfolio in terms of they have a lot of long bonds, long-term treasuries, yields have come down. That will help them. Certainly, they wouldn't have lost substantive amounts from a mark-to-market perspective in terms of the equity piece because that's been hedged. And then, you know, we just continue to have at least some evidence, and I know this is controversial and you know, subject to debate, but at least some evidence that the world is has no growth or is actually deflating, and so their deflation swaps or deflation derivatives could have enormous value for the company at some point. So again, you know, they're not entirely a reinsurer. They do have a reinsurance presence, but they've got a huge primary presence as well. you know, I continue to believe that over long periods of time, Fairfax will be a wonderful, wonderful investment. We certainly, it was our largest position a year ago when we presented that the Wide Moat Investing Summit is our largest investment position today.
Wonderful. Thank you for that perspective, Jeff, on Fairfax. And also thank you so much for sharing the idea of Polaris with us. Certainly very interesting business at an interesting valuation today. It's always just such a pleasure for us to learn from you.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity and would love to do it again sometime.
Well, we look forward to it. Thanks. To all of you listening in and participating, thanks for doing so. And